You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Does humor have logic? Can it be reduced to a formula? And is it possible to analyze a joke without killing what's funny? Peter McGraw, professor at the University of Colorado Boulder, and writer Joel Werner attempted to do just that, not the killing part, unless you mean slaying the audiences. Their quest inspired a 91,000-mile road trip over five continents, telling jokes and doing experiments on the unwitting. Their book, The Humor Code, is published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased to welcome Peter McGraw and Joel Werner to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
Peter, am I to assume this journey was done completely in the interest of academic research?
We always would quip, for science. We're doing this for science.
And did you make a proposal, have to subject it for funding?
Well, you know, we thought about just holding like a yard sale and figured that that'd get us to L.A. and back. Uh-huh. And so the kind folks at Simon & Schuster took a chance on two unknowns promising the world.
Joel, you say you're a journalist by profession, but you've never been completely comfortable in your field.
Yeah, I think a lot of journalists go for the hard stories, you know, the stories all about tragedy. I've always been interested in what I call magnificent obsessives, folks who are so passionate about something they open up worlds to people.
So when you made the book proposal, did Simon & Schuster respond positively or did they just laugh at you?
They hopefully laughed a bit and they said maybe these guys can keep the laughs going over several years, 91,000 miles.
Well, actually, it is an interesting topic, but a lot of people have tried to analyze humor in the past, and haven't most of them failed?
Yeah, the tough thing is that people a lot smarter than the two of us have tried to do this. Plato, Aristotle, Hobbes, Freud, you know, the great thinkers have at least dipped their toe into this big question.
And some of the I presume serious titles of academic papers you reference look like they could be joke setups, like The Messianic Tendency in Contemporary Stand-Up Comedy, and also, did Hitler have a sense of humor? Did he?
Well, I like to think that everybody has a sense of humor if you can find the right topic and the right time, the right medium.
Well, how did you wind up covering humor as part of your academic career?
Well, it's certainly not something I set out to do. I was doing research in decision-making and emotion, and I actually was studying what ended up being a related topic, what makes things wrong. And while giving a talk one day, I talked about something that was wrong and ended up getting big laughs.
Mm-hmm.
And
once you get a big laugh, then it becomes addictive, doesn't it?
Indeed. And I was asked, why am I laughing at this? And I had no clue. Came back home and said, this is an important topic. We should work on this.
And what was it that got you the big laugh?
I was talking about this church in Tampa, Florida that had a real problem, need to get people to go to their winter retreat. And they hosted a raffle for a yellow H2 Hummer SUV. And that was supposed to be wrong, and it ended up being wrong yet okay to this audience.
Well, that has incongruity built into it. And it seems to me a lot of humor is based on incongruity. We're expecting a thing to go in one direction, and then this thing that is totally incongruous winds up being the punchline.
Sure. I think a lot of jokes do fit that concept. However, there have been studies that have shown that surprise isn't always necessary for humor. I think it was in the 1970s there was a study of a variety of Bill Cosby and Phyllis Diller routines where they had one group of people rate or guess the punchlines for the setups coming up in these routines, and they had a second group rate how funny they found the punchlines. And as it turned out, the punchlines that were the most predictable were also the funniest.
Oh, really? Because if I see a punchline coming, then the joke is already ruined for me. No, sometimes I've even said the punchline with the comic.
Yeah, I think the idea of incongruity is a really powerful one. It's intuitively very appealing. What we've been finding in the Humor Research Lab is that incongruity is not enough. And it's not enough for a particular reason, is that if you only look at funny things, you can find surprise. But the problem is that there's a lot of unfunny things that are also really surprising. And so it's not a good theory that differentiates the funny from the not funny.
Well, do people find the same things funny around the world? Are there certain things that they find funny everywhere?
It was one of the concepts that we looked at. And we actually decided to travel to the place that we assumed we'd find the most foreign kind of comedy. And that was Japan. And we set it on some of these crazy Japanese game shows. Mm-hmm. And in truth, we did not get a lot of this Japanese comedy sitting in on these, watching these game shows be taped. But then afterwards, we
you didn't understand what people were laughing
at. Yes, we didn't find it very funny. But then afterwards, we were sitting in the green room with some of these comedians who were performing on these shows. And we didn't have a translator. We didn't understand the same language. And yet we were cracking up over kind of rude kind of body gestures and kind of more kind of organic, simpler humor. I think you can find some real connections there.
You have to find the universal. So mother-in-law jokes are fairly universal. Physical comedy, fairly universal. And so in that
slipping
way,
on a banana peel, we get a laugh everywhere.
It's pretty universal. Those physical types of comedy really stick.
But it is interesting that the silent comedies seem to have more of a universal appeal than the more modern comedies, which rely on setups and jokes.
Yeah, because
one-liners.
Because you don't need language, right? So one of the things that happens is, so I hear that you're quite the punster. And as someone who likes puns, you realize how nuanced oftentimes that form of comedy is.
Well, I realize it, but a lot of people who are listening just simply go, ugh.
Right. And so when you have physical types of things, so this is actually relates to our ancestors. So apes, bonobos, chimps, and so on engage in rough and tumble play. Well, rough and tumble play is a lot like slapstick. It's a harmless attack.
Did Darwin believe that humor had an evolutionary purpose?
Well, I think all evolutionary folks do. What they do is debate what purpose it actually served. So is it an issue of natural selection? Is it an issue of sexual selection? That's where the big debates occur.
What was Freud's take on humor?
Oh, he had this well, obviously it was related to his theory of personality. He essentially said that the humor is this release of aggressive or sexual tensions. It's sort of a safe way to go about living, being human, and doing the naughty things that we ought not to do.
So it's a release of sexual tension.
Or aggressive
tension. I'll have to remember that. Blaise Pascal, a religious philosopher.
Incongruity.
Oh, okay. So I agree with Blaise Pascal on something. Can you describe the N plus V theorem?
Yeah, so this was actually a really important paper for us. Sadly for the author, Thomas Veitch, a linguist, he published it in a journal that wasn't getting much attention. But my collaborator, Caleb Warren, and I, a graduate student at the time, we stumbled on this I'm not proud to say this, but we were doing a Google search for humor theories and found the N plus V theory. And it really serves as the foundation for the research that we're doing in the humor research lab and a theory that Caleb and I have been developing.
And what is the theory? And is it something that holds true in all cases?
Well, there's sort of two levels that you can judge one of these theories. So you could judge it as the end-all, be-all, totally correct theory. And Joel will tell you he's not a big fan of the theory at that level. The other level is to say, is it better than incongruity theory, the most dominant one? And the basic idea is that we laugh at things that are wrong yet okay, or as we say, benign violations.
Well, Joel, you're not the scientist here, but do you see scientific experiments possible to discover what makes things funny?
I think that's why I was attracted to the approach that Pete was taking. I mean, he wasn't just trying to cram all the jokes he could think of into one concept. He was running real peer-reviewed research in his lab and trying to disprove his own theory to see how it holds up. And many of those studies have now been published in some of the top peer-reviewed journals. Now, as Pete said, I traveled around the world with this guy. I saw his theory in action, and I was impressed, but I'm not about to say yet this is the final theory. I do think it does help illustrate that the best comedy is this really, really good mixture of both pleasure and pain. I think that's important.
So getting back to the Japanese game shows, what made people laugh? What happened on those shows?
This is interesting. So one of the things that Americans don't often realize is that the contestants on these game shows are not regular, everyday Japanese people. They're professional comedians. And so that helps explain the damage being inflicted on them in a way that people can laugh about, because these are professionals willing to subject themselves to this kind of torture in the name of comedic fame. That helps make these violations okay.
So the audience just thinks that they're normal people who are being put through terrible situations.
Japanese audiences know that they're comedians. But when, as an outsider, as an American watching one of these shows, you don't realize this is the case.
So what happens? Can you describe it?
One of the segments that we watched, it involved a comedian having to dip his face into a giant pot of boiling soup to pick up fish balls with his teeth. And that, you know, and this was
that's hilarious.
Now, one thing that was fascinating is that we spoke with the giant comedy company that produces all of these shows and has all the comedians, and they pointed out this whole concept came from the States. In the 1950s, they were looking to expand their television offerings, and they looked to the variety shows that were here in the 50s, and they've stuck with that concept over the years, and yet because they've stuck with it, they've had to push it further and further, and they've had to keep pushing the envelope.
Now, you went to different parts of the world. You went to Tanzania. Would I find the things you saw in Tanzania funny?
Well, you wouldn't find our hotel accommodations funny, I'll tell you that. We actually went to Tanzania to try to understand, why do we laugh? Why do human beings engage in this sort of peculiar behavior? And as the setting, we examined a laughter epidemic that happened in the early 1960s, that was sort of really perplexing. These young schoolgirls started laughing uncontrollably, and then it spread sort of like a virus through the school and into neighboring villages. And so we spent some time in the Bukoba region trying to find what exactly was going on.
And what happened? I mean, I've been in an audience where one person could get everybody else laughing. Laughter can be contagious. But we're talking about something much bigger than that.
Yeah, I mean, it's contagious. So both this epidemic and laughter in general are contagious. What we find is that they share some of the same stimulants. So one is, there's something wrong with the situation. In an audience, it's one that you find is wrong and okay, a benign violation, and it's helpful to signal to the world that you see that. In the case of the laughter epidemic, it ended up being a case of what we call mass motor hysteria, and it's a reaction to extreme stress.
And did people try to stop it?
So the way that you usually stop mass motor hysteria, which, by the way, happens all over the world, happens in modern times, is you remove people from that place of stress. That's the best solution for it all.
Mm-hmm. But why did it happen in Tanzania? Do we know?
The best explanations that we heard from some of the researchers who were there at the time was that this was a time of transition in the country. They were just moving to statehood, and it began with these schoolgirls who had just started attending these strict Catholic boarding schools. They were taking away from their families and their villages, and all of a sudden they were feeling constricted. And so they found a way to voice that feeling of oppression.
There is one thing that's important here, is that one of the values of actually going to that place was we came to a conclusion that first reason, this independence, is questionable, because this was happening in remote villages that were largely unaffected by the change, by the independence. But yet there were these still challenging situations that they had locally.
On another level, you write about a man named Greg Dean. How did you hear about him?
Joel found him.
I found him. We went to Los Angeles to look at how you create, how people are funny, how you actually become a successful comedian or whatnot. And there are a variety of comedy teachers in Los Angeles. And apparently the longest running is this fellow named Greg Dean in Hollywood, who teaches classes all the time on how you actually be funny.
He has methods of writing jokes.
Yes, and his theory is actually based on the work of a different humor researcher named Victor Raskin. It's called the script opposition theory, which is it's kind of similar to the incongruity, where you begin with one script, the setup, and then halfway through you switch scripts to the punchline.
Now, delivery is also important. For example, the late Henny Youngman was a guest on this show, and I kind of knew the way he constructed jokes, and yet he had me howling with laughter because he just did it so well. I suspect that some of those jokes wouldn't have been as funny from somebody else.
Yeah, first of all, I want to apologize for not being as funny as Henny Youngman.
But that's also a pretty high bar.
It is, indeed.
But he told jokes that had a certain formula to them. Mm-hmm. Take my wife, please. Well, I mean, that didn't make me laugh, but you know. And yet, even knowing that he had that kind of formula, he still was hilarious.
Yeah, Henny's an interesting case example because he's an outlier. So people have a tendency to believe that this big, fat pause between setup and punchline is a really important component of comedy. The research actually doesn't bear that out, that if you analyze the setup and punchlines of comedians, you don't find that pause. Actually having them close together in many ways is beneficial. It's just Henny has created his own special form that makes that work.
There has been a debate over the years of whether humor sells, is good in commercials. You looked at that. In fact, you looked at a public service commercial that recommended the use of condoms. Is humor a good tool in talking about condoms?
Well, I think in many ways, humor makes sense in marketing. It makes these concepts more memorable. It's more likely to share these concepts if you find them funny. But the research hadn't really been conclusive yet in terms of whether humor actually helps sell things. So at one point working on the book, the National Campaign to Prevent Teen Pregnancy reached out to us and said, look, we are really trying to push the envelope with these humorous PSAs, but we want to know if the humor works. So we flew to Washington, D.C., and we created multiple versions of the same kind of sex ed PSA. Several that used different kinds of humor, and then one that was just a straight, dry, boring reading of the facts. And then Pete at Hurl ran a study where people watch these commercials and then see if they sought out more information.
Hurl is H-U-R-H.
Capital H.
Lowercase U and then capital R-L.
Yeah,
capital
the Humor Research Lab.
That's right.
And he found that the straight, dry reading of the facts encourage the most people to seek out more information as opposed to any of the ones that used humor.
But the humor, on the other hand, I'm sure got people's attention.
Yeah, so it's sort of a trade-off that you have to make. Do I want to cut through the clutter or do I want to change people's behavior?
People think that they're funnier when they've taken too much alcohol.
We experienced that during our New York trip. We took a bunch of madmen out to a fancy club, got them drunk and had them create humorous content. And all along the way, we had them judging how drunk they were, how humorous the content was, and then subjected it to experimentation at the Humor Research Lab to see were they right.
Well, they also probably could have looked at it the next day and decided whether it was as funny as they thought it was originally. Were any of the things really funny?
Yeah, this is a really talented group of people. They do this stuff for a living. So in general, the stuff they came up with was funny. The problem was is that they thought it was getting funnier as they moved from drink two to drink three to drink four to drink five. But our respondents in the survey, we had more or less a flat line. Things stayed about the same.
What is the humorous behavior Q-sort deck?
So there have been multiple attempts over the years to try to find a way to rate people's sense of humor. And it's been a huge challenge in part because no one can agree on what a sense of humor really is. Is it your ability to tell jokes? Is it your ability to appreciate humor? Is it your ability to remember funny things from movies and radio or TV? What some researchers have gone to instead of saying how funny you are is in terms of how you use humor in your daily lives. So one of the tests involves 100 different rating cards. You have to put in stacks. I think there are six different stacks. It takes a good amount of time, 45 minutes to 1 hour, to do this whole survey. And so Pete and I decided to subject ourselves to this study. And what was striking is that of all the variations that we could have had in terms of how we use humor in our daily lives, we were incredibly similar in our results, which was probably a good sign considering we had to travel around the world together.
Well, humor can be cruel. One person might think a cartoon in a Danish newspaper about Muhammad is funny, and the next person will think that it is the most terrible kind of blasphemy. Often the cruel part does lead us to question why we find certain awful things funny.
Yeah, indeed. Actually, it wasn't until rather recently that people, scholars, thought of humor as a positive thing. So Plato and Aristotle thought of it as a negative thing, as coming out of a feeling of superiority. Hobbes talked about this laughter arising from sudden glory, and it really focused on the kind of comedy that looks down on others, celebrates people's failings. More recently, though, and you can still look back through time and find how humor can be used to bring people together, to share a laugh, to share a moment together, or to look up and to speak truth to power, to point out what's wrong in the world and bond people around that.
On the other hand, it can also be cited as a human rights violation by the UN.
We actually looked into that human rights violation. We went to Denmark and Sweden and looked at the Muhammad cartoon controversy of 2005, where a dozen cartoons in a Danish newspaper published under the headline "The Face of Muhammad" triggered international turmoil, and it was declared a human rights violation. And we met with some of these cartoonists, several of whom now live under 24/7 armed security because there have been multiple threats on their lives. And I think one of the big takeaways from that experience was, these days, thanks to how interconnected we are, jokes, it's becoming increasingly likely that jokes can fail spectacularly. Originally, these cartoons were meant for a fairly local audience. You know, this was a fairly right-wing newspaper. It knew the people it was trying to appeal to. Most of these cartoons didn't even show Muhammad in them. One of them was making fun of the newspaper and just showed the 12-year-old boy who the person just said his name was Muhammad, and he was making fun of the newspaper. But when this stuff spreads, when it gets picked up online or gets picked up by television around the world, that context is lost. So folks in, say, Syria had no way to know that the cartoonist who drew the 12-year-old boy making fun of this right-wing newspaper wasn't making fun of the prophet.
Well, there also, it can get you in trouble. Gilbert Gottfried got in trouble for a joke about 9/11 and then later one about the tsunami and wound up being punished economically as a result. He lost a whole bunch of jobs.
Yeah, so Gilbert's really committed to his character and to the too soon joke in ways that most of us aren't comfortable making.
You also looked into the jokes in The New Yorker, some of which are funny, some of which we don't get, some of which just seem lame. What does Bob Mankoff say about all of that? How does he determine what would go into the magazine?
Well, Bob's a friend, and he's really a generous one. He gave us the keys to the vault, so we got to work with him and to look at the cartoons, at the cartoon caption contest, and we had some spirited conversations with Bob. He makes an important distinction. He doesn't necessarily believe that the cartoons have to be funny. He's more interested in having cartoons that make you think. And from our perspective, it's that difference between aha and ha-ha. So you can have a clever, insightful cartoon, you could have a funny cartoon, or ideally, you have one that does both.
Does he have a theory as to what the readers think is funny as a result of the cartoon contest, as opposed to what the professionals might think is funny?
One thing that Bob told us was that he sees each cartoon as a heat-seeking missile. in that no one cartoon is going to appeal to the entire audience, even of, say, The New Yorker, that there are different cartoonists and different types of cartoons to reach different audiences. And so in some ways, even looking at these images, he thinks like an editor, thinks about trying to find different missiles to hit different parts of this audience.
So after all of this research, what are your conclusions? Are there ways of testing what is funny and what isn't funny?
Yeah, there are, but that's not really why we wrote this book. We ended up writing this book because we wanted to move outside the laboratory. We wanted to meld science and comedy, two ideas that don't often get along. And in that way, what we hope the reader takes away from it is just a better understanding, not only of what makes things funny, but all the places it touches us and all the ways that it can touch us, both in a good way and potentially in a bad way.
Peter McGraw is a professor at the University of Colorado Boulder, and Joel Warner is an award-winning journalist. They have collaborated on a book called The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being on our show.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks for having us.